It's always a surprise when I get up here. Hey, God is good
all the time.
Thank you for being here this morning. And we did get a little break in weather this week, didn't we? Had some rough weather, but it finally got around to something a little bit easier to handle. We're starting on something new this morning. Every now and then, I just got to figure out something new, something different, and quit doing these one-shot deals, I guess. And I like to kind of get on a theme and stay with it. And it's time to get started here. And I want to go to Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. This is the Sermon on the Mount. It's the longest single discourse of Jesus that we know about. There might have been others. They just didn't get recorded in our Bibles. And Matthew's version is three chapters long, 105 verses, and all of it's red. I mean, this all stuff that Jesus said. There's another version of the Sermon on the Mount, except it's not the Sermon on the Mount. This is the Sermon on the Plain. Different, slightly different, a little different emphasis, and a little bit shorter, about 32 verses. You go over to Luke chapter 6. That's just verses 17 through 49. And there are some differences in the emphasis, and you know, I think the thing you have to realize about everything that Jesus taught here, and the reason that some of these Gospels have different versions of the parables. I don't know, have you noticed that Jesus tells the parable one way here at one place, and you go over to Mark or you go over to Luke or whatever, and he tells slightly differently. And the reason being is Jesus told that parable probably 100 times during the course of his ministry. He was traveling around all over Palestine. And everywhere he went, it was a different crowd, a different time, different things had been happening leading up to it. And I think he told those parables, they were basically the same, but he told them just a little bit different each time. And when the gospel writers record these things, they get recorded a little differently. I think that's what happened here with the Sermon on the Mount. You might have noticed this in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 1, it says, Jesus went up the mountain and his disciples followed him, and then up there on the mountain, that's where those three chapters happen. And then in chapter 8 and verse 1, he comes down off the mountain. And guess what? The disciples come down with him, but the multitudes are waiting for him when he gets down to the bottom of the mountain. The multitudes that didn't go up the side of the mountain when he went up. But he was on a mountain. Luke chapter 6 and verse 17 says the verses that are there were things that he said on a level place. So about the same time, but just a different group. And I think you got to remember that there was no mass media. There was no paper, Jerusalem Times, that Jesus could write his editorials in or do his column. There were no TV programs or any of that. All the information that he had to pass on to people, all the teachings that he had to give, had to be repeated every village, every family, every group, every little nook and cranny if he wanted to get it out. I think he depended a lot on his disciples to repeat a lot of that for him, as the prophets of the Old Testament also did. But the Sermon on the Mount begins with nine Beatitudes. Each one of them begins with the word blessed. And that word blessed means happy. And we're not going to do the Beatitudes today, but I just want you to think about them. These are the ones that say, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. All of these words, all of these things, you could take the word blessed and you could replace it with happy. Happy is the man who's poor in spirit. Happy is the man who mourns. Happy is the person who hungers and thirsts after righteousness. Happy are the meek. Happy are the merciful, and right on down the line, happy are the people who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. I know that just kind of goes against the grain. It doesn't sound right that person would be happy. But Jesus is telling us the keys of happiness, real happiness. And I want you to notice that Jesus placed them at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. He starts off with these things, and I think of them, therefore, as the foundation for the rest of the sermon. And maybe sometime we'll come back and talk about the Beatitudes, one or two at a time, but we're going to kind of skip over those, and I want to go ahead and go to our scripture reading this morning from Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. That was what was read to us from the scripture this morning. And the first thing I want to say about what happens here, let's read those verses. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. When Jesus finishes the Beatitudes, he starts right in with this business about salt and light and all of that. And I think there's a connection between the Beatitudes that Jesus has just given to us and this business about being salt and light. He's telling his disciples, he says, you know, you're salt, you're light. And I think there's a connection. I think if someone really gets into those Beatitudes and makes each of those Beatitudes a part of his life, he becomes pretty salty, and he becomes a pretty effective light. He's like a city set on a hill. And in that way, I think there's a kind of a connection here. Anyway, he starts off by talking about people who are light, disciples who are light. That's chapter 5, verse 13. Now let's just get that one verse up there. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt has become tasteless, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You know, that's a compliment that we pay to one another every now and then. We say, well, that guy's just like the salt of the earth. When Jesus was paying a compliment to his disciples when he called them the salt of the earth. And I want you to think about, why does Jesus compare his disciples to salt? Well, lots of things we could say here, but I'm just going to say a few. A little salt goes a long way. It doesn't take very much to do the job. And a little salt can make a big difference in how something tastes. And so Jesus was talking to his disciples up there on the mountainside. They would always be in the minority. They were definitely in the minority at this time. I mean, this is at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. There's not very many of them. And out of those few, he eventually chooses the 12 who are going to be the people, the disciples for him, the apostles, the 12 that are going to, you know, carry the ball for him once he's gone from this world. But the point is Jesus explains to his followers as you go along through the Gospels, he says, you guys are going to be in the minority all the time. Just a few of them compared to all of the Roman Jewish society. Well, the disciples of Christ are like those few little grains of salt compared to the whole plate of food. I don't know, you know, you can put your food out there and you can eat it and it has no taste. It's bland or whatever. But you just put a few little grains of that salt on there and all of a sudden, man, it's good. It begins to taste better. Without the salt, it's bland and tasteless, and with the salt, it's good. And one of the jobs of the disciples, as Jesus explains it to us here, he says, you guys have to be salt. You have to make the world taste better. And when you think about it, there's a lot of mean, ugly, disgusting, selfish, destructive things happening out in our world. A lot of mean, ugly, selfish, destructive people wandering around. And how refreshing and how encouraging it is to run in to salt. To someone who makes our world taste good. The saltiness in us, in disciples, is Christ. And even though we may be in the minority, Christ is so potent that all of society is blessed by the presence of those people who have the salt of Christ within them. It's hard to imagine how great that influence has been. I mean, we live in a country where there's been a lot of influence from the salt of Christ and through his disciples. For many hundreds of years. What would it be like if there had never been any Christian people here in this country? If the Bible had never been here? If the church, the Lord's church, had never been here? What would it be like if the saltiness of Christ had never been sprinkled on the world? I know there's a lot of people who think this would be a whole lot better place. Everyone would like it a whole lot better if Christians would just disappear. And if we'd throw the Bible out or get rid of them, or if we'd quit talking about God, or if the churches would all just be torn down. I know probably there are some atheists who think that this would just be almost heaven if we could get rid of all that stuff. But I don't think they really know what they're asking for. I mean, it's one thing for them to say that. But it'd be a whole other different thing, I believe, if we had somehow rewound our history back to 1776 and played it out without the influence of Christ in this country. I think it would be a very different place, and I don't think anybody would like it particularly, even the person who says, I wish it'd all go away. Well, we're never going to know that, because when Jesus set up his kingdom, this is the prophecy from Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, he said in the days of the Roman Empire, he said, God is going to establish a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. It will never be replaced. And in the days of the Roman Empire, in the person of Jesus Christ, in the preaching and teaching of the apostles, the eternal kingdom has been established, and it isn't going away. And so I don't guess we have to worry about that influence ever entirely going away. It may be in the minority. It may shrink. It may expand. We hope, but we know it's not going away. So Jesus compared his disciples to salt. And the first reason I think he might have done that is because a little salt can go a long, long ways, and it makes a big difference in how our world tastes. And then he says something about the salt. He says, you know, saltiness is something that can be lost. Salt is only useful as long as it's salty. But if you store it improperly, I don't know how you get rid of the saltiness of salt, but there's various ways, I suppose. But I know if it gets damp, it kind of leaches out all the stuff that makes it be salt. And it's not good for anything. And Jesus warns his disciples in this verse right here. He says, be careful. Warns us and his disciples there. He said, be careful you don't lose your saltiness. Because the minute we lose it, our usefulness is gone. We have no power to make the world taste good anymore. We're not going to be a blessing to other people anymore. And maybe even worse, maybe we might even leave a bad taste if we lose our saltiness and actually become a hindrance to the spread of the kingdom of God. So now let's talk about this light. In verses 14, 15, and 16, Jesus begins to talk about light. And there it is. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light, the King James says, so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. That's the New American Standard, and I usually use that, but the King James keeps sticking in my head, so forgive me if I say it wrong. So Jesus compares his disciples to the light of the world. He says, you are the light of the world. Over in John chapter 9, Jesus said that he was the light of the world. He says, I am the light of the world. And then but here he's saying, you disciples, you are the light of the world. And I think what he means is, you know, I've got the light, and my light's in you, and it's going to shine out there, so I'm kind of dependent on you to do the shining and spreading this light around. And so he says, you guys are the light of the world. And then he compares the disciples to two specific sources of light. He says, you're like a city set on a hill that cannot be hidden. And he says, you disciples are like an oil lamp in a house where that would be lit and put on a lampstand. He wants them to think about themselves as those kind of lights. So now, why does he compare his disciple to these lights? Why talk about a city set on a hill that can't be hidden? Well, in the ancient world, almost every town or village or city or whatever was almost always established on an elevated place. It wasn't like the people that first built New Orleans and found a hole and put it in right by the sea. People were smart back in those days, you know. They had brains. And they looked for places that were elevated for various reasons. They looked for an elevated place that had water beside of it. And they looked for an elevated place because they said, you know, we might have to defend this place sometime. You know, there's armies that come through here from other places, and we'd like to have an elevated place where we can build some walls and maybe protect ourselves from attacks and all that kind of thing. So there were certain characteristics that people looked for when those first little villages and establishments, cities were formed. And usually it was a high place. And over the centuries, those hills where those little villages and towns and all were established actually grew in height. Because the reasons that the first people who built there put their city there, and then 200 years later, someone comes along and wipes them out and levels the city or whatever, and so you got a layer of debris right there. But the same reasons that caused them to build there, the next group that comes along goes to that very same place. There's water, it's high, and all this. And over the course of time, over century after century after century, and this is especially in the part of the world where Jesus was, the hill gets higher and higher and higher. And so in the excavations of ancient cities there in the ancient Near East, in the Middle East today, there are cities where when they begin to excavate below the current level of the city, they're going down 40, 50, 60, 70, sometimes 80 feet through the debris of older peoples, older cities that used to be on that site. My point is that the cities build up. They're always on a high place, and over time they've actually gotten higher. But they were first established. They were always higher than everything else around. And the result is that the cities were always visible, especially at night. You know, they're up high, so you can see them through the day. But if you're out on that plain, you're walking along, the city is visible at night too. Because even in ancient times, those lights, and there would be a few lights on in every little village, every little town, just a little bit of a glow. It would rise up out of the walls of the city or would be visible from long distances away. I know you've probably had the experience of riding in an airplane and looking out the side window as you ride along. And it's at nighttime. And when you go by, you'll see these islands of light way over there. And the pilot will stop and say, well, that's Cleveland or that's Chicago there on our right or our left or that's Nashville or whatever. And all you see is a big pond of light way over there as you're riding along. The city is giving off its light. Anyway, a city set on a hill cannot be hid. You just cannot, because it's up high to begin with, and especially at night, the light comes up. A city set on a hill cannot be hid, nor should it be. Jesus wanted his disciples to be visible like cities on a hill. Especially in a dark world. It's just a natural thing for a city to be visible. It'd be almost impossible to hide a city. And we cannot really hide the fact that we are Christians. Nor should we try. Jesus is telling us by these words here. He says, be who you are, wherever you are, with whomever you are with. And if you ever find yourself in a situation where you are trying to conceal the fact that you are a Christian, you're doing something very dangerous to yourself, and you're definitely torpedoing the ministry that Christ has for you. If you ever find yourself in a situation with a group of people where you are not comfortable for them to know that you're a Christian, you need to stand up and tell them you are, or you need to get out of there. One of two things. Because when you start to conceal or hide the fact that you are a Christian, well, I would say this about the light more so than what I'm going to say, right? When you start to conceal the fact that you are a Christian, that you have the light of Christ in you, that's the first step toward extinguishing that light. And you do not want to lose that light. Well, Jesus wanted his light to shine through at all times. He wanted people to know that over here, where the light is, there would be help and safety. So the lost traveler could be walking along in the dark, he'd see the glow of light, he'd know where to come. And that's what we're supposed to be for the people of this world. Now he also says to his disciples, he says, you're not just like a city set on a hill that can't be hidden, but you're like a lamp that gets lit and set in a house. And this is the other example of light. And the example here is, how ridiculous would it be to light a lamp and then cover it up? And so Jesus says, nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. It'd be ridiculous to light the lamp and then put the basket over top of it to keep the light from shining. The only reason a lamp would be lit was to make it so people could see. And so Jesus is telling us the reason we exist is to give light. And if we ever hide or conceal that light, we are denying the reason that we exist, and we are defeating the purpose for which Christ has created us. So Jesus says this in James 5, or Matthew 5, 16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. So there's three lessons here I want you to think about concerning discipleship that come out of what Jesus has said here. First one is this. There's no such thing as secret discipleship. Jesus, when he began to think about disciples, it was never a part of his plan for anyone to be a secret disciple, undercover agent, so to speak. He wanted everybody to be who they were, wherever they were, just be who you are, and don't worry about the consequences. Just be your light. Be a city set on a hill. If we belong to Christ, it's not supposed to be a secret. We're supposed to let the light shine. There really is no containing it, concealing it, or hiding it. We are cities set on a hill. We are lamps designed to give light. Now, I know this is hard for some people, because there are people who have no problem at all with that, and then there's people, I'll just call them private people. They're kind of uncomfortable being open about things like that. You know, they're kind of a guarded sort of person. And so when that person becomes a Christian, sometimes, you know, I don't think it really matters when you become a Christian or how many people are around. But that person would probably say, you know, I want to confess Christ, I want to be baptized, but I don't want to do it in front of 250 people. How about let's come over, how about let's do it right now? Let's don't wait for the assembly to come up. Or let's just do it right now, it's Friday night, or we'll meet tomorrow night, or whatever. But I'm a little bit uncomfortable about being in front of a lot of people when I make my confession of faith and I'm baptized. And I understand it, and I think that's fine. But you know what we do for that person? We do this for everybody. The next time that we assemble, we make sure they're here, and then we call their name, we make them stand up, and we clap for them. Because that's their first opportunity to publicly stand up and say, yes, I'm a Christian. I'm a city set on a hill. I'm a light that's been lit, and I'm going to give off my light. And this is your first opportunity to do that. So just because you're baptized Friday night at midnight doesn't mean you get to sneak and be a secret agent. Just doesn't happen. But anyway, we shouldn't be wanting to hide that anyway. I had something happen to me one time, though. It didn't happen to me, but it happened to at the church where I was. I had just gotten to this church up in Michigan. I'd been there about 6 or 8 months, and one of the young women in the congregation that I had thought her husband had become a Christian, but I didn't know that she had. And for some reason, she calls me off to the side one day, about 6 or 8 months into the thing, and she says, well, I want you to know something. And I said, what is that? She said, well, I was baptized about 6 or 8 months ago, but I never told anybody. I said, really? I said, I know about it. She said, yeah, before the former minister left, she said, I asked him, we studied, and I decided I wanted to become a Christian, and I confessed my faith to him, and I was baptized, but we've never told anybody. And she said, but I think I'm ready now. And I said, well, you know, what was the deal anyway? And she said, well, it's my family. She said, I come from a family that's really strong in the Jehovah Witness religion. And they would be very upset with me if they knew that I had done what I had done. It's okay for me to come here, but they're praying. They're really concerned that I'm coming here. But they would just flip out if they found out that I had become a Christian. But I finally got to the point where I think I can break it to them, and I'm just going to tell you, and you let the elders know, and then do whatever you have to do. So the next, we had a meeting with the elders right after that. Well, the elders went ballistic. They said, what? They called the preacher up down in Alabama, and they said, hey, buddy, what are you doing? They got after him. And the reason being is, when a person begins to hide the light, that's the first step toward extinguishing the light. It really is. The light is supposed to shine. Well, now, it turned out all right. I mean, she owned up to it, and I think she's doing fine now. But it was just something that really concerned the elders of that congregation. But my point here is this about discipleship. When Jesus talks about discipleship, there's no such thing as undercover disciples. There's no secret disciples. you're out there and you're on a hill and the light is shining. Here's the second thing you need to think about. Be careful of your motive when you let your light shine. Now see what it says up there in 5:16. It says, let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works. But why, you know, they're going to see your good works, but what's supposed to happen now? Well, that your Father in heaven will be glorified. In other words, it's okay for other people to see your light, but you need to let your light shine in such a way that if there's any glory at all in it, that it's going to be reflected upon God, your Heavenly Father, and not on yourself. So you got to be careful of your motive and how you go about this. Sometimes you have to think about things like this. Some people get stuck in Matthew 6, the first verses there. And the reason I'm saying this is because in Matthew 5:16, it's like Jesus says, let your light shine before people. And then in this place right here in Matthew 6, verses 1 through 4, we're going to read all four verses. It's like Jesus is saying, don't let your light shine in front of people. There's a problem with it. So let's read this. Matthew 6, 1 and 2. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who's in heaven. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. Truly, I say to you, they have the reward in full. But when you give to the poor, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, so that your giving will be in secret, and your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. Now, this is what Jesus said about giving. If you read the next verses, he talks about prayer. He said, don't go out in the middle of the street and pray a big loud prayer so people will see you and think, oh, what a righteous guy you are. And if you're going to fast, he says, don't make yourself look like you're all haggard and beat up and starving. He says, go on about your day, and it's just something you're going to do. If you're going to do this so people think you're some hot thing religiously, he says, no. He says, you're missing the whole point. But this is what I'm saying here. So he talks about this motive business. Is there a contradiction? Look at Matthew 5:16 again, and then Matthew 6:1. Just put them side by side. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works, glorify your Father's in heaven. And Jesus turns right around just about 40 verses later. Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. Well, see, what he's really saying in Matthew 6:1 is be careful of your motive. Be careful why you're doing it. If whatever it is you're doing, if you're doing it to be seen of men, to impress people, he said the best thing you could do is go get in a closet or just shut up or don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. But if you look at Matthew 5:16, that's a different motive, isn't it? If your motive is right, then God says, go right ahead because you're doing it so that I will be glorified. And so if the motive is right, public or private, isn't an issue at all. And here's the bottom line. Jesus wants disciples who are unashamed to be his disciples and to do all that they do to glorify the Father. It's not about them. It's about the Father. So now here's the third lesson I want you to think about. How do we let our light shine? Now, what I'm going to say here is you have to listen pretty closely to catch this. I heard Charlie Hodge talk about this one time up in Royal Oak, Michigan, and I've never forgotten what he said because, man, it hit home with me. He said, there's a difference between shining your light and letting your light shine. He said, I know lots and lots and lots of Christians who will get out their little lights and they'll let them shine. And they'll go over here, shine their light for a little while, and they'll go over here. Maybe we'll go to the nursing home now. We'll let my light shine my light, and I'll go over to the hospital. I'm going to shine my light here. And I'm going to church tonight. I'm not turn my light off until I can time to go to church. Oh, it's 6:30. I better turn my light on. I'm going to church. Okay, church is over. Going home to the family. Light's off. I want to go to work tomorrow. I'm not turning that light on. Not there. No way. But when I get home and I'm going to go do something else, and maybe I'm going to do my neighbor needs a little help. I'm going to turn my light on here. I'll shine. There we go. I'm letting my light shine. I'm shining my light. And he says, and you know, some people approach this as if they had a little flashlight in their hand that had a switch on it that they could aim just any time they wanted to. But when they didn't need for the light to be on, they could take it and just poke it in their pocket. And that was kind of over and done with until they needed to pull it out. An emergency come up, you know, hey, we might need some more light here. I put a little more light. I'm shining my light. So now let's talk about letting our light shine. The light that Jesus is talking about doesn't have a switch on it. And you can't aim it in one particular direction or one particular place. It's kind of like, you can't switch it on, switch it off. It's either there or it's not. And if it's there, it's supposed to shine. I know you've read about this in the paper or maybe heard about it on the news, Yahoo or somewhere. There's a light bulb in Livermore, California, in the firehouse that houses engine company number 6 that has been burning or functioning as a light bulb since 1901. It's the oldest usable functioning light bulb in the United States. They had the 100th anniversary. This thing, it became a thing back in the 70s, how old this light bulb was. In fact, it was still burning. And they've been very careful not to turn it on and off any more than they absolutely have to. There have been some power failures and things like that. But they want to coax this thing along just as long as they possibly can. They even have a webcam on it now. A webcam so the people of Livermore, California can look at their light bulb that's burning in the fire station. And back in May, it went off. And they thought, well, finally, the thing burned out. I mean, 112 years. I mean, that's a pretty good run for a light bulb. I buy these light bulbs all the time now, these CFL light bulbs, 5 years. That's a lie if I ever heard one. That's the biggest hoax ever perpetrated. I like those kind of just, you know, those incandescent bulbs. And now they're illegal. I can't believe this. But there it was. The light went off. And the webcam was showing that the light had gone off. And the people are saying, oh, no. They had hooked it up to what's called an uninterruptible power supply. So there's a special battery backup and everything. This is a 4-watt light bulb, but it makes a good bit of light. But they had put an uninterruptible power source to this thing so it wouldn't be going on and off with power failures and things like that. They want to keep the light going. They're using it, but it had gone off and they assumed that the light bulb had burned out. And then they got an electrician over there and he said, no. The light bulb's fine. It's your uninterruptible power source has gone down. Go get an extension cord. We'll plug it in and we'll be gone. We're in good shape. And they did. They hooked it up and it's still burning. But there's no on-off switch on that light. There's no intention of turning. It might go off with a power failure every now and then. But there's no intention of ever turning that light off. The kind of light that Jesus was talking about is a kind that would never go out. Ever. For any reason. And it's not pointed in any particular direction toward some special group of people or some special time or whatever. It's a light that stays on and it just glows and it gives off its light and it just is who it is, wherever it is, whoever it's with, whatever's going on. It is just who it is. And that's the light that Jesus was talking about. And that's the difference between shining your light and letting your light shine. And there's a big, big difference. There's a huge difference between a disciple who shines his light and a disciple who lets his light shine. We are cities set on a hill. We cannot be hidden. No one lights a lamp and then takes a basket and covers it up. And this difference is important. This difference between shining your light and letting your light shine. Because there's constant pressure from this world to dim the light, to hide it, to turn it this way or that way, to turn it off for a little while. There's all kinds of pressure on us to do that sort of thing. There's constant pressure on us to keep our salt in the shaker, never let it out. There's pressure from the world. But we cannot do the Lord's work. We cannot be who God's called us to be without maintaining the difference. Being lights that shine and not people who just shine their light every now and then. Romans 12 and 2, the Apostle Paul talks about this. He says, do not be conformed to this world. In other words, don't let the world crush you down and make you into some little pile of, make you turn off your light or keep your salt in the shaker or hide your city that's set on a hill. He said, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So here's my questions from Matthew 5, 13, 14, and on through 16. Have you lost your saltiness? Would you be trying to hide your light? Or are you just shining your light, or do you let your light shine? Or is light just gone? And if you do let your light shine, is it more about impressing other people about what a great guy you are? Or is it about glorifying the Father, your Heavenly Father? Those are all things that Jesus brings up in these four short verses. Those questions come up. And those are the questions I want you to think about today. And maybe there's someone here who's never become a Christian. And we're going to sing this hymn. I sing our song here. We're inviting anyone who has never confessed their faith in Christ and never been baptized to do that today before we leave. And you will be a child of God having done that. And maybe there's a Christian here who just needs to rededicate themselves, get the light on again, take the basket off, do whatever it is, get the salt out of the shaker. And you know it's time to get that straightened out. We're going to sing our hymn. If